Welcome to the Inclusive Activism Podcast. This podcast is about being inclusive, making sure that you're active, and then trying to find a place and space to make sure all people are validated and valued for who they are and what they bring to the table. It also originates from Dr. Martin Luther King's statement that if one is going to be an activist, they should be an activist for love, and I am just that. Also, the inclusive activism means that you're doing something, that you're active, that you're part of the process, that you're actually making things happen. This is a space for us that believe that we is greater than me and helps us to understand ideas and concepts related to the concept of inclusion and how we can get a little bit better at helping people feel as though they belong and are truly valued, as well as doing the personal leadership it takes to do this type of work. The purpose, again, is to look at like diversity and inclusion, how it relates to personal leadership, and how to get a little bit better. I, of course, as always, am your host, Rowdy Duncan, and I am here for all things related to the idea of inclusion, as well as how you can make you and your team better through the opportunity of inclusive and transformational leadership. So today, it's been a cold day after a few false starts. I usually write the podcast before I start talking about the podcast, so there's been a couple of false starts, there's been a few noise issues I had to work around, and I had to get a couple of personal things done as before we got to sit down and record, so I'm really looking forward to the opportunity to kind of like dig into this idea and get a little bit more comfortable in explaining these concepts and ideas to you. Again, kind of still working on that whole conversational tone thing. I've got my ritual going now. I burned some peppermint oil to kind of open my nasal and lung passages so I can talk to you a little bit easier. I'm drinking my Breathe Deep tea, and I'm sitting here ready to get a hold of you and this idea. So what we're going to talk about today specifically is the concept that you cannot compartmentalize social change. That means if you're trying to do good in one space, you got to do good in spaces a lot wider and bigger than the spaces that you might consider otherwise. So we're really widening out the notion of just change in a specific area and looking at change in general. What does it take to do and create that change? What does it take for you to look into doing that change? And what does it take to be the type of person that's going to make a change happen, not just covering a symptom or an issue, but then also looking at how we can like wider flatten that out to another sense of wider systemic change in places that really need it. So first off, let me explain things to you on how I try to see the world on a macro level. I think that will help the idea of how we can create change and why we need to look in many different spaces and places when it's time to create change. There's two different major theoretical standpoints that inform my point of view. So the first one of those is systems theory. So system theory looks at how systems are put together, how do they fit together, what does one thing need to rely on another, why do things need to be in a sense of stasis or balance? And then two, what happens to a system if it is out of balance? What happens to a system if one area of the system is getting too much benefit and it's coming at the cost of another space in that system? So looking at that systems, really looking for a balance and a space where things can be sustainable moving forward in the future. Also looking at a system that also helps us consider what is our role in the system and how are we acting in that system to keep the system in the space that it is. A lot of folks think that just doing your day-to-day and keeping your head down, not really bothering or hurting anybody else is a good space to be, a space where they're doing no harm. For me, when I look at that and through the lens of systems theory, I look at the concept that you're complying. So in complying with a system and the way that it's built and doing the things that's asked of you through the way you were socialized, you're complicit in reproducing a system. So communication is a form or a tool of reproduction of forms and norms in society, but it's not even close to a form of trying to reproduce justice. So when we're looking at trying to find justice, equality, stasis, we need to look at things different than just in a space where we're only complying with what's happening and we're pushing against what's happening to create a better sense of justice for all, for the benefit of all people within that system. A system that works to benefit a few at the cost of some is not sustainable and eventually will fall in on itself. We see this in nature, we see this in the rise and fall of many political systems and history. So when we're looking at systems theory, we're trying to look at a way of how can we help to challenge privileged norms which oppress part of our system, and then expose the hidden costs to the way the privilege is upheld to the whole. Because even people that are getting the benefit are hurting others, and that's damaging the we, right? So the notion that a few can disproportionately benefit over the needs of many is antithetical to the notion of systems theory. The way we're doing things or the way that we're operating needs to be revisited, otherwise that system will crash. So we're really trying to find a way to like bring advocacy into systems thinking. So that's why a big reason why system thinking, I think, is really important, and systems theory is something that really informs the way I view things and the way I think we need to look at stuff moving forward. A quick example of systems theory and why you'd want to look in a systems way, especially within the idea of diversity and inclusion, is looking at the idea of why is adaptive technology for folks that have less than normative ability so expensive? The reason that it happens is because there's an avoidance of looking at the fact that we're all going to be less than completely able all of our lives. And so we put the burden of adaptive technology onto folks who have a disability and don't look at ourselves or in the future where we're going to probably need that adaptive technology ourselves. Like, for example, right now I can hear okay, but I know in the future I'm going to have some hearing issues and hearing problems. So as a what would be considered hearing person, I would need to use my hearing privilege to put pressure on folks that are adapting hearing technology to lower those costs, not just for the people that need it now, but also that I will need that in the future. Additionally, there are both things that I may never need. One of the examples of those is reading software. I may never need a reading software because my eyes currently are fine. At the same point in time, potentially my vision can fail or my mother's vision's really bad. I have to look beyond just me and think about we, and then really challenge the notion of the way we do things with adaptive technology in a systems perspective, because I am only temporarily abled right now. At some point in time, due to age, due to getting older, or accident, or whatever else, I'm gonna be in a space where I do need adaptive technology. So understanding that I'm just in a space right now where I will need adaptive technology in the future is something that could like help me, as well as everyone else, understand the need to look at things from a different perspective when looking at systems theory specifically. The other major way in which I kind of see the world is through a critical lens. I'm very careful with my critical lens because I feel like it's really simple to get stuck into a space where all you're doing is criticizing, you're not actually doing anything. But at the same point in time, looking at what's good, what's bad, what's better, and how we can move to better, I think is really important. I love applying critical theory to myself personally, but I also think just analyzing things from a critical perspective at all times can really be a place where you don't move forward and you only get stuck in the same type of thing, or you only just get used to criticizing things over and over instead of actually doing something differently. I love looking at critical theory through the lens of communication because we talk in a way that favors some folks and then subverts different groups. This looking at communication and how it holds up one group and then subtly oppresses another with the way that it talks is constantly fascinating to me. And I think that's where I like the concept of inclusive activism, because it helps you think of new ways to change language to create new notions that are more equitable across the board. So I try to blend systems theory and critical theory to come up with my informed view of how I see the world. So how does that make a difference with this notion of that you can't really compartmentalize social change? When you look at both, you see that all things really interconnect, and that noticing that the imbalance in one space really disrupts the balance and stasis of a system that's meant to be for, be with, and serve all. Nature, again, is a great example of trying to find a sense of homeostasis, a natural balance, a place where you're always in a process of working to find balance, and balance is never complete, it's never done, it's always strived for. And necessary because you need to find a place where all things are getting what it's needed while all things are actually currently being distributed at the same time. So that makes this a very active process. So the first concept with the notion you can't compartmentalize social change is going to come with the fact that you have to see the system. You got to be real with it. You have to understand your role in the system. So for me, as an active anti-ist and a lover of inclusion, that means I must work to appreciate diversity and inclusion in all spaces, and then understand that everyone's different and everyone's going to come at diversity in a different way. I tend to like the way I do diversity and inclusion, but that's not the only way to do diversity and inclusion. Loving diversity means I need to have a really wide scope of appreciation for many different things. And to a degree, I gotta really try to come at ideas from a very open space and receive what's being given to me. So I have to try to see the value in all things, good or bad. Additionally, I need to be willing to consider things from many different perspectives. For example, one of the main loves that I have when diversity and inclusion work are specifically about race, racism, and then positive masculinity. Be on the lookout for a YouTube series about positive masculinity in the near future. I did a research project in my master's program about masculinity, and I found that there's not a lot of versions of positive masculinity. It's just hyper-masculinity and dominance and control. And so I want to try to find a way to talk about how to do masculinity in a way that it's positive and affirming and helps others and doesn't reproduce notions of negative masculinity or control and power and dominance specifically. So be on the lookout for that. I'm really excited about talking about it. But I have to understand it within my own work that the biggest threat to diversity is thinking differently. So when I have students that want to work on sustainability, my first thought is that is not a topic that relates to diversity and inclusion, but I'm wrong. Sustainability is a very wide concept. And the funny thing is social sustainability is my whole reason for existing. It's my whole deal. It's the straw that stirs the tea. It's something that really matters quite a bit to me. And even other sustainability concepts like gardens or trying to address the triple bottom line, which is an accounting framework that looks in three parts. It looks at the social bottom line, the environmental or ecological bottom line, as well as financial bottom line, and understanding that all three of those bottom lines are just as important if you're going to be a sustainable business is something that's really important. And I love the triple bottom line idea. I wish more folks worked from that standpoint. But my goal is to push students who do want to look at sustainability and not just make a garden in their area to make their garden look nice. Like, I would want to push them on the concept of environmental and socioeconomic racism and then try to get them to apply those sustainable practices to the areas of most need. Where and what spaces need the sustainability the most, and what could we do to get the places that need sustainability and the most crucial areas. So when I would challenge them to in making a community garden, I would say, hey, please don't put that community garden right next to you in the happy space that you already exist in, right? I can get my own peppers from my own garden. That's nice, but it means much more to put a garden in a space where people are in like a food desert where they don't have the ability to access fresh fruits and vegetables to give them access to the area of most need. And there can be a way to make that sustainable, right? You take some, they take some. We find a space where people work together to get all their needs met. And we really bring those sustainable practices into a place where they're most needed. And then the practices in a place where we're really creating the most balance, trying to use sustainability, not just within the place that you're at, but in the place that we are at. A great example of this notion of environmental racism is the Dakota Access Pipeline that's being fought over in Standing Rock. Residents in Bismarck, North Dakota didn't want it, and it actually asked the route to be rerouted to another area, which got put next to a Native American reservation, and they put the pipeline in access to a lake, which is their only source of fresh water. So if the pipeline spills and infects their water, there basically is no water. This is a place where I really would love to see sustainability folks out in force talking about the importance of ecology, why water is really necessary. And I'm sure there are people there. I can't say I know what all's there and what all's not there, but I'm not seeing an outcry from people in the land of sustainability about the Dakota Access Pipeline going through the reservation. And that's a sustainability problem. That's a sustainability issue, but that's also how environmental racism works. It ignores people that are put at most threat. And two, like, it kind of can manifest as a form of like white sustainability. You're like, yeah, you like sustainability, but you think of sustainability as very flat instead of seeing a space where people need it the most and how we can get it to the folks that need it the most. To reiterate, we really have to think wide and systemically about what you're trying to do and what are all the repercussions, and then how can you take your social change to a place that really needs it, or how can you actually try to do the thing that you're looking to do best in the places that need it the most. For example, I have friends that are pro-life. When I speak with them about being pro-life, I would ask that they be, if you are going to be pro-life in all ways, right? So be, it's got to be more than you want people to not have abortions. What are you going to do if that person doesn't have an abortion? Are you going to help give them food vouchers? Are you going to help give them education vouchers? What are you going to do to help that? Let's be real. It's an unwanted child. What are you going to do to help that unwanted child in the world have a life, right? I mean, be and think pro-life. And another thing that can be frustrating for me specifically in pro-life is where are the pro-life people that are working to make adoptions just as inexpensive and easy to access as abortions? You know, if the goal is really trying to make sure kids get to spaces where they're really loved and valued, then how come all I see is your efforts to not get people to have abortions rather than being pro-adoption, right? Like, how can you really look to make sure that you're being pro-life in a holistic and systemic way? The second main concept that I wanted to address today is, how do you limit good, or when is good work done? When I was younger, my best friend Ryan Walker and I would focus on two things. We wanted to help the world, but we didn't want to get caught up in saving the world, I guess. And so the two things that we would try to do is, if we found the lost dog on the road, we would do everything we could to try to help that dog find its owner, right? That's good. Another thing that we would do is also try to help. If someone had their car stalled out in the middle of traffic, we'd get out of the car, help push that person's car off the road, and then help them get their car to a safer space. You know, everybody's had been in that space where their car's broken down and the two random strangers or a random stranger helped them push their car off the road. That's great, right? It's a good thing. It's not a bad thing at all, right? But we only concentrated on those two things. That was only, and again, this is us years ago. We only concentrated on those two things specifically. But we, you know, it was clear in what we liked, right? We wanted to help be the hero when someone had their car break down and make sure that they were okay. And we wanted to make sure that dogs found their home, right? That was the goal. That was the space that we were looking at trying to make the difference, right? That's what we wanted to focus on. What we didn't do is think about next steps. So say, okay, we rescued that dog. And that was amazing. We helped it find its home. Everything went really well. They found their owner. Great. We feel good. We know, like, Scrappy found their way home. Fantastic. But at the same point in time, what would we do about the dogs that we couldn't get to? Say we were busy and we're trying to get to work and we know we'll be late. What about that dog? Or what about the dogs that are currently in Maricopa County sleeping on really cold floors because there's not enough volunteers at the Maricopa County Animal Shelter? Like, what are we doing about that? See, I would say we were more about trying to feel good and look good than really make a systemic change. And that's kind of the idea when I say we can't compartmentalize social change. That's the idea that I want us to, like, think about and really deeply dive into. In a completely other vein, there was another night where we helped a woman push her car off the road, and it was really late at night. Again, great, right? Doing good things, trying to be good people, trying to do good stuff. Well, I mean, it's a great first step, I guess, sort of, but we weren't thinking about a lot of things. You know, we were early in our 20s and hadn't had access to a lot of the things that I do and know now. So I didn't really think, we were really blinded by like our young maleness and didn't think about like two, you know, guys coming out of the darkness, like to push a car and what that might mean to the lady. Were we help? Were we a threat? You know, we didn't understand that many women, especially in the dark and especially in a situation like that, have to be worried about the deep prospect of rape. We were coming at the situation from our own points of view, trying to, again, right, be the hero, push the car off the road. Hey, make sure she feels good. What did we do to, like, ease the concern of rape in that moment? What did we do to help make sure she wasn't just off the road, that she got back to a safe situation? What did we do to try to navigate the fact that we needed to show ourselves as not a threat? Because I can tell you, we didn't even think about it. It wasn't even a concern, right? The other thing I would say with that is, like, when are we done with that lady? Do we stick around as like a potential threat to her? Does she want the help? How do we ask for the help? Understanding it's dark of night. Would she even want the help? Or would she rather someone get out of a AAA car and help her specifically, because the threat of rape goes down quite a bit? So, you know, when you really look at those things, when we did save Scrappy the dog, or we did push the woman off the road, were we done? I would say not at all and not really. Like, we were drops in the bucket. We were definitely good. But I think we were just handy in the moment. We didn't make any type of positive systemic change, and that was kind of the issue. One of my best friends that helps push me on notions like this, his name is Alberto Olivas, told a story about people giving blankets out when it's cold. You know, people giving out blankets when it's cold to people that are cold is a good thing, right? But it's covering, and I think maybe you're doing a thing just because you want to feel good versus you want to help the cold people be warm. Blankets and making sure people have blankets is a good thing, but what's like the best thing? The best thing is trying to make sure we can get the people that need the blankets in a space where they have access to warmth whenever they want it, not just blankets to starve off the cold as much as necessary. So what are we doing instead of just giving people blankets to feel good about ourselves versus trying to make sure people have access to heat and making sure people have access to shelter so they don't need blankets in the first place? Giving somebody a blanket makes you feel good, but it also keeps you from really understanding. Yeah, it doesn't really help if, I mean, I guess it does help, you know, if you have a blanket and you're sleeping under an underpass, that's better than not having a blanket, but it's definitely not as good as being in a house. So we really want to think systemically about what we can do to maximize the good and not just limit the good to the idea that we had in the moment. There cannot be a limit to the good that you're looking to do. You should always be looking at a place where you can like maximize the good or do a little bit more good in the future. All right, so third concept, and I'm gonna warn you, this one's tough because there's no right or wrong answer to it. It's just, what are you gonna do? You can't do good without living out the good in your life. So for me, that would be like, can you work against ism without conspiring against it? Again, like I said, this is a really hard one. How do you do and live what you care about? And then when do you stop? And when are you done? And how much do you want to do? And what do you do publicly? And then what do you do privately? And I think some of it's obvious, right? Some of it is so I work against rape culture specifically. In working against rape culture, do I not listen to songs that talk about rape culture? And trust me, it's taken some time to help divest my playlist from rape culture songs. But it's important, right? Because like the song, the catchiness, what they're talking about, that type of thinking, it bleeds into you and it poisons you and it helps normalize rape culture and make it something that we don't feel as though we need to actively push against because we're listening to it. We have a mental knowledge of what this is, but we're not living it out. We're not actually doing it. For years, the song Talk Dirty to Me, which is just a rape culture bomb, was on the Diversity Incorporated playlist. And it's taken a really long time for me to get to a place where I'm like, yeah, that's not inclusive. And it's really time to get that out of here. Again, like some of this stuff is going to completely make sense, right? I can't go to a Klan meeting as an inclusive activist. But then there's other stuff. For example, I love pit bulls. Like, I'm going to be rescuing pit bulls for the rest of my life. But I like to listen to some DMX songs. DMX fought pit bulls to death. So do I listen to DMX? Well, it's not DMX, right? It's DMX's songs. And so I'm not really supporting DMX, I just like the song, right? Except doesn't listening to the song still support DMX? And then, you know, I helped him in his legal battles against the charges for pit bulls. I mean, you see where it gets complicated, right? I've really delved into this topic specifically with my friend Don. When we talk about our support of the NFL, we really like the NFL, we like football, we appreciate the game quite a bit. But as inclusive activists, we've had a hard time with the NFL, especially with their total reactionism on the subject of domestic violence. When they got called out on domestic violence, they became domestic violence advocates, huge domestic violence advocates. But it wasn't until they got called out, and then two, when they did it, they're doing it because they got called out. Like, I don't believe that they care about it. I believe they're protecting their brand. Even more complicated, do I support them even though they're all complicit in the violence and harm that's happening to the players? I mean, the players are complicit in it. They kind of know the threats that are happening. They know what they're getting into, right? They're aware of that stuff. But then two, where are these players coming from? Would they be able to make the same amount of money doing something else? You know, one of my close friends is really excited about going to a regional combine to hopefully get into the NFL. Am I cheering for him to get CTE? I don't know. I mean, that's difficult. In watching such gratuitous violence of people slamming into each other's, you know, I'm a personal nonviolence practitioner. What am I doing in watching this violence, and what is that violence doing to me? I really, really love football, and I know the NFL is getting better in small steps, and I know the game is getting better in small steps, but I don't know if they're really taking it like as seriously as they possibly could. And then lastly, as a feminist male, like, where do I stand on pornography? Personally, I'm doing everything I can to try to avoid it at all costs, but then I've also been educated by some feminist women that can see it as a form of empowerment, or them being able to really choose what they do with their bodies rather than being told what to do with their bodies. But then the pornography industry is a huge supporter of human trafficking. It's one of the major places human trafficking comes from. As a man, it's definitely not a very positive form of masculinity, seeing these images, and I think it pushes forward a example of masculinity that's really damaging as a human to men. And when there's a huge need for more forms of positive masculinity. And then two, let's be real, there's, you know, tons of men that have had struggles with it, with addiction. Like, I know I've had my own struggles with addiction with pornography, and continue to struggle with it. It's not like that's ever done, and it's really difficult. And what do you do about it? Do you support it? Do you support women's access and ability to do it? Are you against it? I tend to lean more against it and trying to be more outspoken against it specifically, but at the same point in time, I can't recognize my struggles or the complexities that are contained therein. And I really don't have a good answer for what you do with this, right? All I can tell you is you gotta be good and not just look good. In Philippians 2:12 in the Bible, one of the best lines in it says that you have to work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. I feel like you gotta be your harshest, best critic on this type of things, on these things too. What you listen to does matter. What TV shows you watch do matter. You know, are you gonna say something, or are you just gonna passively consume stuff? Where are you gonna draw your line in the sand, and when is enough enough? I know I'd had my own struggles with a lot of the rape that was happening in Game of Thrones, but if I'm gonna be honest, I'm still watching it. When will I be done? When is enough enough? And am I only just looking good, or am I going to take the challenge of actually being good personally? I need to reconcile my public and private self, and I need to make both of those things who I really am. Because I can't just talk about things on one hand and then not do them on another. Because it's going to bleed into who I am and how I act and what I do. So again, in summarization, it's the three walkaways that I want you to leave with today in the area of personal leadership and diversity and inclusion in the subject of you cannot compartmentalize social change. First on, you have to see the system and make sure that you're working towards a cure and not just covering a symptom. Too often, we just cover in symptoms and we fail to really try to work ourselves out of a job. We should all strive to work ourselves out of a job. we should all be people that get jobs to lose jobs because we're so good at no longer needing to do the thing that we were hired to do. I'm not necessarily hired to be a diversity and inclusion specialist, but wouldn't it be great if there was no longer a need for me doing that thing anymore? Number two, when is a good thing done? Are you done just because you did one good thing, or do you need to keep working on the good thing? Are you trying to just cover the problem in the moment? Are you working towards a systemic cure? Are you only being good so you can look good, or are you being good because you want to stop the problem and you want to find a way to do things differently? And then the last one is we all got to do the hard work in all areas of our life, not to just look outwardly good. We need to engage in that personal leadership of becoming good. We need to have a deep, good character and not just look good when it's time to talk about stuff. All this work needs to be done, and we need to stop worrying about like presenting good and do the hard work at home when it's time to look good. We need to be good, like all the way good. So with that is my time. This is, again, one of those first original six podcasts, and I know there's no one going to be calling me quiet yet, but if this made you think something, if you have a reaction to it, if you want to have a question, or even more shocking, a critique, please give me a call at 860-576-9393. Again, that's 860-576-9393. That is my Google Voice number, so I never answer that. I'm just going to be listening to voicemails on that. But this is a space to ask me questions, to hit me with scenarios of how to react to situations in full time or get my take on something like that. And depending on how good the stuff or the thought that you have is, I might give it my first take response in the moment. Or if it's something really deep that merits its own area of discussion, I might make it through a future podcast. And lastly, as always, if you're interested in booking me to help bring the power of inclusive activism to your organization, please email me at Rowdy, R-O-W-D-Y, Duncan, D-U-N-C-A-N, at cox.net. That email again is Rowdy, R-O-W-D-Y, D-U-N-C-A-N, at cox.net. Or you can learn more about this organization at www.inclusiveactivism.com. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I'm looking forward to getting more content out there. And I appreciate every person that took the time to listen to what I had to say. I'll hear from you next time. Bye. We'll be right back.